planning. One of the reasons I put the reading by Ludwig von Mises on the middle of the road, Policy Leads to Socialism, is he talks a lot in that essay about how interventionism in general, price controls and so forth, lay the groundwork for socialism or a planned society. So we don't necessarily have to be talking about centralized, comprehensive planning. And I'm going to sort of talk about something that I touched on last week, and one of the quiz questions was about the extent to which we do have a planned society through regulation. And I did mention last week the article by our friend George Reisman on Mises.org that Grayson put up on the chat group, where he pointed out that we have about 40% of government spending takes account for about 40% of all national income. Then on top of that, we have all these regulatory agencies and commissions. And I've added a little bit to that. You know, last week we mentioned George Reisman's comment that there are 9 executive branch cabinet departments that regulate pretty much all aspects of the economy, from housing, transportation, healthcare, education, energy, mining, and so forth. And if you go on the White House website, whitehouse.gov, you'll see the claim that there are hundreds, in the plural, hundreds of federal regulatory agencies and commissions. If you just Google federal regulatory agencies, you'll get one of the listings will be the whitehouse.gov that says this. And, you know, among the better known are the Army Corps of Engineers, Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, Commodity Credit Corporation, Commodity Futures Trading Commission, Consumer Product Safety Commission, Department of Veteran Affairs, and just on and on and on, the FDIC, the Federal Election Commission. It covers almost everything. And as George Reisman also pointed out, there are 73,000 pages of tiny print regulations in the Federal Register that regulate just about everything. Now, on top of this, state and local governments regulate a lot of economic behavior. There's a list on statelocalgov.net, state by state, of what of the websites of the state governments, and I just took a look at Alabama's, you know, the first one alphabetically, Alabama. And what does Alabama regulate on top of all the federal regulatory bodies? It regulates retirement systems, geological surveys, public health, education, conservation, natural resources, industrial relations, agriculture, seniors, tourism and travel, veterans affairs, environmental management, forensic science, business development, rehabilitation, banking, insurance, labor, transportation, children's affairs, alcoholic beverages, filmmaking, ports, disabilities, arts, real estate, and even faith-based initiatives. And that's a relatively conservative state with a relatively modest state government compared to, say, New York, California, and a lot of others. And so we've got another gigantic layer of regulation there. And then there's the Fed. We all know about the Fed and its manipulation of the money supply. But there's a publication by the Fed called The Federal Reserve System, Purposes and Functions. And in addition to monetary manipulation that has been creating boom and bust cycles since 1913, the Fed regulates all aspects of finance. And this is just the Fed. On top of the Fed, you've got the Comptroller of the Currency, the Office of Thrift Supervision, the FDIC, the Securities and Exchange Commission. They also regulate financial markets. And the list of things that the Fed regulates is mind-boggling. I'll read some of my list. Bank holding companies, state chartered banks, foreign branches of member banks, edge and agreement corporations, state licensed branches, banking agencies, and representative offices of foreign banks, non-banking activities of foreign banks, and there are about 30 other things. And it's very comprehensive, and including the Community Reinvestment Act. The Fed proudly boasts that it is one of the enforcers of the Community Reinvestment Act that for 30 years, more than 30 years now, has extorted banks into making bad loans to unqualified borrowers that are called subprime loans. And we're all familiar with those. And the language is kind of interesting, isn't it? Subprime. It sort of implies that if you had a prime credit rating of, say, 850, maybe 848 would be subprime. But, of course, we're talking about people with credit ratings of maybe 350 not 850. And so, in addition to that, you know, some of you, I think somebody mentioned, I had a question, one of the questions about some of the czars. Any of you can look up the czars, Obama's czars, on the web. But of course, he's not the first to appoint czars to cover a lot of our economy, to regulate and regiment the economy. William Simon was the first energy czar in the early 1970s. He was also Secretary of Treasury. And so we started with the central planning of energy from the very beginning. And Simon was supposedly a free market conservative. And so we've had czars. I think Bush the second had 16 czars. But among the list of current czars that we have, there's an Afghanistan czar, there's an AIDS czar, there's an auto recovery czar, border czar, California water czar, central region czar, this covers the Middle East, a climate czar, domestic violence, drug economic czar, Paul Volcker, energy and environment. There's an Iran czar, a Mideast peace czar, an oil czar, a manufacturing czar, and on and on and on. So in addition to all this federal, state, and local regulation, we've got all these dictatorial czars out there. And I'll close this little discussion by quoting Hayek, who warned in The Road to Serfdom. He said, "There's no justification for the belief, so long as power is conferred by democratic procedure, that it cannot be arbitrary." And of course, that's what we have here. All of these agencies exercise largely arbitrary power over all of us. And I've always been mystified as to why politicians would have chosen the word czar, since it so obviously meant dictator, essentially, dictatorial power. But they revel in it. And so if you look at it that way, this whole discussion of economic planning and the road to serfdom really is relevant, as relevant as ever. To us today, because we've been there. We've reached near the end of the road of serfdom as far as economic regimentation, and it's hard to make a case that we don't have a socialist economy for the most part as far as that goes. And so that's one point I wanted to make. And the point that Hayek makes, that economic planning affects all aspects of our lives, not just the economic aspects, not just our jobs and our income, but pretty much everything. I want to illustrate that with a quote from von Mises, where he talks about the importance of private property, because all planning, regulation, regimentation by the government is what we call an attenuation of property rights. An attenuation is an interruption, interference with property rights. And why is that important to our lives in general? Here's what von Mises said. "Private property creates for the individual a sphere in which he is free of the state. It sets limits to the operation of the authoritarian will. It allows other forces to arise side by side with and in opposition to political power. It thus becomes the basis of all those activities that are free from violent interference on the part of the state. It is the soil in which the seeds of freedom are nurtured and in which the autonomy of the individual and ultimately all intellectual and material progress are rooted." And so, all of this regulation and regimentation is an attenuation of private property. And that gets me to, there's an old article from the Financial Analyst Journal. It's probably possible to dig it up, but I don't know. It's a long time ago. It was 1978 by Michael Jensen and William Meckling. And way back then, 32 years ago, they were forecasting that all of the regulation and rent-seeking and politicization of society spells doom for capitalism. They were very, very doomsayers 32 years ago. And why is that? The reason is all of the regulations, not all the regulations, but most regulation is an interference in private contracts. And private contracts are one of the sole bases of capitalism. And they also destroy the life of the corporation. I mentioned in the last class, I think I alluded to von Mises, who made the point that with regulation, what you have is the use of coercion, government coercion, to force business owners to abandon their primary business of catering to their customers by improving their products, trying to cut their prices, developing new products, research and development, everything that goes into business success. They have to abandon that and obey the orders of bureaucrats. And so every new regulation is a fundamental attack on the heart of capitalism. And in light of all the piles and piles of regulations that we have, we've certainly done a lot of damage to it. And way back in 1978, Michael Jensen and William Meckling were alarmed over it. They were trying to sound an alarm bell in the Financial Analyst Journal of all places. And of course, things are much worse now than they were way back then. And so that's, and of course, certainly much worse than they were in 1944 when Hayek was writing this. And one point I would add to what Hayek says about how economic planning affects all of our lives is a good example of this is how we don't really have free speech in a regimented and regulated society like ours. Some of us do. It's all a matter of degree. I certainly mouth off a lot on the internet and elsewhere. Many of you do too. Especially in the business world, business people, for the most part, are intimidated by the state because if they do speak freely about government policy in a negative way, they risk retribution, more regulation, a tax increase on their product, tax audits by the IRS, and so forth. And the government has been doing this forever. It always has been doing this. And so business people can't speak freely. That's why so many of them donate so much money to some of the more market-oriented think tanks. It's a way of using charitable contributions, which are tax deductible in the U.S., to give to groups that they know will be friendly toward their ideas. They don't necessarily pay them to say this, you know, in particular, to say any particular thing. Sometimes they do, and most of the time they don't. If they donate to the Mises Institute, for example, they know that their money will be used to promote free markets. And if they think that they will thrive in freer markets rather than more restricted markets, well, then that's a good investment. As they see it. So businesses don't really have free speech, and neither do a lot of people. Of course, if you're living on a state payroll, it's very dangerous for you to criticize the state. And that's one example of what Hayek is talking about here, I think. And he's also talking about a very fundamental issue regarding economics, you know, in terms of the study of economics, where most of the textbooks start out is with scarcity, the realization that scarcity exists in the world, economic scarcity, that we can't always get what we want, as Mick Jagger has often said in that famous song. And he studied economics for a semester, by the way. I've always wondered if that gave him the idea for the lyrics of that Rolling Stones song. But anyway, if we start with scarcity, that requires choices. There's no free lunch. We have to make choices. How do we make these choices? Well, they're based on our own subjective preferences. Of how we evaluate whether we want to spend that $100 on a new pair of shoes versus putting it in the bank and saving it or buying beer with it or whatever. And the whole thing about planning is that it eliminates the domain of freedom of choice and it puts the choice making over resource allocation in the hands of these anonymous and unaccountable, for the most part, government bureaucrats. And so, just look at what's happening with nationalized healthcare, for example, and all the mandates that are going to be coming there. The latest I read about myself today in today's newspaper is the government wants everyone to take a body mass index measurement. It measures body mass. It's the government's new measurement of not necessarily of fat, but body mass. From what I've read, they count muscle as the same as fat and body mass. There was an article in the local paper here in Baltimore that said that most of the members of the Baltimore Orioles baseball team would qualify as clinically obese, according to this, because they're big, strong, muscular guys and they have a lot of body mass. But this is part of the government's attempt to regulate and control our diets and to tax foods it decides are not appropriate for us. They want to claim that we have too much body mass and we need to shrink down, apparently. And that's the latest bit of nonsense that's coming out of socialized medicine, which we're on the road to. Hayek also mentions a subject here that a lot of you are familiar with and have probably read a good bit about, is the politicization of higher education. And for years and years, if you studied macroeconomics, you probably would have been exposed to a theory of unemployment called the mismatch theory of unemployment, that says essentially that there's just a mismatch between the jobs that are available out there and the skills that people have for them. Well, I would argue that the federal government's intervention, especially in higher education, and the state governments also, has contributed mostly to this problem. For example, the massive subsidies to universities to put on degree programs in computer science and electrical engineering and so forth seemed to be a good idea, but it created quite a glut of people in these fields because it's not based on any market mechanism. Once you set up a department like that at a state-funded university, you automatically set up a sort of a little lobbying group among the faculty and the alumni and others of that department to keep it going and to expand it, even if there's really not a genuine market for it. Those of you who have attended universities know that there are always these departments with sometimes funky-sounding names. They're not just traditional departments like history or mathematics. There's some sort of weird type of studies departments where they might have three or four or five students in the classrooms, but they seem to last forever because they're not market-based institutions. And so the government intervention in higher education has created that. Another thing that Hayek was warning about that happened shortly after he wrote The Road to Serfdom with regard to education is that, in the U.S. anyway, is that the GI Bill was passed by the U.S. Congress after World War II. And, of course, this subsidized veterans in education, trade schools, universities, and so forth. And so what did this do? Well, this at the time, it was the biggest government income transfer program that existed. It was four times bigger than Social Security at the time, within a few years after the end of World War II. And this was really the camel's nose under the tent, so to speak, of political correctness and political control of higher education. Because what the government then did is to say, well, we need to set up these accreditation agencies to make sure that the money, taxpayers' money, is not going to crooks who are setting up diploma mills and not really providing genuine education and just taking the money and running and giving people phony diplomas that aren't worth much or worth anything. And so they set up the accreditation agencies. And of course, a lot of what they did was genuine. They wanted to make sure that there wasn't people weren't being swindled by diploma mills. That sort of thing did exist. But what it eventually evolved into, what a surprise, is the enforcement of political correctness. And I'll give you a few examples. There's a professor of classical antiquity at Concordia College in Wisconsin named Patrick Riley that I quoted in an old article of mine that I wrote for the Free Market. It's on Mises.org. It's called The Truth About the GI Bill. And he writes about the agencies, accrediting agencies, eventually started imposing diversity standards as a way, instead of focusing on the quality of the faculty, the curriculum, library resources, traditional criteria of what qualifies you as a legitimate university, as far as that goes. They started imposing sort of political standards, diversity standards, which tell colleges and universities what they should teach, who should teach it, who the students should be, and so forth. There was a man named Joel Siegel. He's the former president of Baruch College in New York City. He was told by the Middle States Association of Colleges and Schools, which is one of the big government-approved accreditation agencies. He said that academic excellence and you're being reaccredited, which, and of course, if you're not reaccredited, you can't accept students with government funds, with government loans, and that would bankrupt schools like Baruch College. But he was told that academic excellence, I'm quoting him, must take a back seat to social justice. And of course, that's sort of a euphemism for socialism, social justice. Westminster Theological Seminary in Missouri, they were denied reaccreditation because no one on their board of trustees was a female. And their religion that they practice, like Catholics, does not ordain women as ministers or priests. And all the members of the board of directors of this college were ministers. And so it has nothing to do with the quality of their educational program, but it was just this reaccreditation agency disapproved of their religion. And so those are just a few examples of the sort of things that happened shortly after Hayek issued this warning about the dangers of the politicization of education. And of course, what he was saying in The Road to Serfdom, as you read it, was how uniformity of opinion will be enforced. And of course, that opinion will be friendly towards socialism. And I see it every day because I'm a university professor. I run a lecture series at my university, and I had Walter Williams in, the syndicated columnist, the George Mason University economist, sometimes Rush Limbaugh replacement for the Rush Limbaugh show. And Walter gave his patented talk on limited constitutional government. He's a limited government guy. He's a minarchist. And he has a very eloquent speech that he puts together making the case for limited constitutional government. And I had a crowd of over 200 students in the audience. And the overwhelming response to it was, whether they were freshmen or seniors, is I never heard this argument before. Never at all. I had quite a few seniors in college tell me they had never heard the argument, let alone a favorable promotion of the argument. They were totally unaware that there was a case out there for limited government. They had only heard about unlimited government. And the same thing, I sponsored a lecture by Ron Paul last January at my university, and we had over 1,000 people show up, and I had the same response in the student newspaper, letters to the editor. They thanked me profusely because they loved the whole event, and many of them said, well, this is the first time in my career here as in 3 or 4 years in the university that I ever heard these kinds of ideas. I had no idea these ideas existed. And these are young people who had been through 12 years of primary and secondary school and 3 or 4 years of college and had never been exposed to this. So the universities are doing a very good idea of inculcating just one set of ideas. That's why, and if I could be a bit of a bragger, that's why the Mises Institute, groups like the Mises Institute, are so important, and that's why you need to seek out your own education on the web and anywhere you can find it. Okay, another point that's important here, I think, that Hayek is talking about, when he talks about employment policy, he gets into a little bit of labor economics in these chapters, and he talks about the trade-offs there. And of course, in a free market, we can make any kind of trade-off we want with our employers, we can attempt to. Anyway, and we often do when we bargain for contracts, employment contracts, and so forth. But with planning, you don't. You get mandates. And one example that I would mention here is a law regarding the Americans with Disabilities Act that was passed. What was it? 15 years ago now, or 20 years ago? So it's been around for quite a long time. I wrote an article. We had a conference sponsored by the Mises Institute right before this law was passed. And I can remember sitting there with Murray Rothbard, and the paper I presented was called Handicapping the Handicapped, and I think the Mises Institute still has copies of it. I don't know if it's online or not. But one of the things I point out is that there were a lot of employers, and there had been for a long, long time, if they had valued employees who get in an accident or develop some sort of handicap, it doesn't mean they fire them. They have a handicap, and if they're a valued employee, a smart employer will do what he can to accommodate that person. And who knows better how to accommodate that person than the person himself and the employer? We can work things out. If we need a wheelchair ramp or something like that, or if you need different hours, we work that out because you're productive. You produce $100,000 a year in sales for me. Why wouldn't I want to keep you? But what a law like that does, the Americans with Disabilities Act, is it mandates standards that everyone has to do the same thing. It's like the environmental laws that impose the same clean air standards on rural Montana as they do downtown Los Angeles in Manhattan, which of course doesn't seem to make any common sense at all, but that's what government does, uniform standards. And so that's what Hayek is talking about, things like this. Job safety, look at job safety. How does the market handle that? Well, primarily the market handles that by penalizing employers who have excessively unsafe workplaces, because they have to hire, they have to pay a premium in wages to get people to come and work at these more dangerous workplaces. And so the fact that they are forced to pay more for people to work there is an incentive for them to figure out how to make the workplace safer. And that's how the free market disciplines workplace safety. It won't produce perfect safety. There's no such thing as perfection on earth, but that's a very powerful incentive. The alternative is OSHA regulation, Occupational Safety and Health Administration regulation. And once again, it's usually one-size-fits-all standards for everybody imposed by bureaucrats in Washington who could not possibly know the details of every single workplace and what makes things safe and what makes things not so safe. And of course, this gets into Hayek's knowledge problem again, in that if you want safer workplaces, who knows better how to make those places safer than the workers and the employers, and who has a better incentive than the employer to make things safe? Because it's money. It's money down the drain if he has to pay higher wages just because of an unsafe workplace. And so those are two examples I would use to illustrate what Hayek is talking about here. Okay. And another rendition of Hayek has made the same statement in several chapters. And the way he puts this next statement, I've read this exact quote in a number of places by Hayek, where he says, in a socialist society, the only power worth having is political power. Whether it's what kind of job you're going to get, pay raises you're going to get, and so forth. And that is certainly true. And it's interesting, this was 1944 when he wrote this. The updated version of The Road to Serfdom is parts of his 1970s book, Law, Legislation, and Liberty. And in that book, he incorporates a lot more of the scholarship of the field of public choice or the economics of political decision-making that had been produced in the interim between the time he wrote The Road to Serfdom and the mid-1970s. And so he elaborates much more on what he's talking about here in Law, Legislation, and Liberty than he does in The Road to Serfdom. But he had the right ideas. In fact, the public choice ideas are nothing new. James Buchanan, my old professor, always said that they were essentially just the sort of thinking about politics that some of the American founders, like James Madison, participated in, but brought up to date in the language of modern economics, the lingo of modern economics. But the main ideas are very old. And so, and this is an important point. I think it's worth my spending a few minutes on for those of you who aren't too familiar with it. With the internet, you can always Google public choice. You can Google James M. Buchanan, who won the Nobel Prize in 1986 for being one of the co-inventors of this sub-discipline in economics, public choice, and learn a bit about it. Buchanan once said, anyone who understands public choice, if they're true to their beliefs, cannot be a socialist. Because the typical socialist argument that Hayek is taking on here commits what some economists call the Nirvana fallacy. They compare the real-world markets, which are never perfect, with some sort of Nirvana or utopia, which of course is always perfect, and then they proclaim that the markets have failed. But what public choice does is to compare real-world markets with the realistic alternative, that is government allocation. And so this whole area of scholarship does this. And one of Buchanan's earliest articles in this area was on the subject of what he called political externalities. And it was simply the realization that in a democracy under majority rule, the minority that loses the election is going to have imposed on it a policy that it doesn't want. And just like pollution is called an externality, an external cost imposed on somebody else, apart from who created the product, the factory creating steel or whatever, there are political externalities. If I voted for a candidate who wanted smaller government, but the bigger government candidate wins, I get bigger government. I get Barack Obama, and I have to put up with it. That's a political externality. And so from the very beginning, as imperfect as markets could be, you have a giant government failure here by the very nature of majority rule democracy, political externalities. And then we also recognize the idea of rational ignorance, that the average voter is rationally unaware of most of what government does. In fact, government is so busy and does so many things, no human being could possibly understand more than a tiny, tiny percentage of 1/10,000th of what even one government agency at the federal level does. So it's just impossible to know much about what government is up to. Even those of us who write books about it know only a tiny bit. And what that means is that most government decisions will be made by special interest groups who do have an interest in making sure government does what they want to do. And so that's another market imperfection. Government is inherently short-sighted in a democracy also. The emphasis is always on the next election, which is always right around the corner. And so politicians of all parties have an incentive to spend as much money now as they can and to defer the costs into the future or to hide the costs some way with some sort of hidden tax in costs that we'll have to pay at some future date. And so despite all the criticisms of capitalism being short-sighted, well, a short-sighted business person will pay a price for that. If that business person doesn't sufficiently invest in research and development to keep up with all the new products that the competition is coming up with from all over the world, that person won't be very successful in business, may go out of business. That doesn't work in government. In government, short-sightedness just keeps going on year after year after year. And so, and that's another problem with government. Not to mention the incentives of bureaucracy that we've mentioned very briefly earlier in this course, in that there's no market feedback mechanism in the government, of course, where profits are the reward for good service and good products and low prices, losses are the penalty. You don't have that. In fact, in government, failure is success. And we sure are seeing a lot of that now with the government created the boom, which has busted, the Fed in particular, and also all of these agencies of the government, such as HUD, the Community Reinvestment Act, Congress itself, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, that all fueled the subprime borrowing market and all fueled the overinvestment in real estate for years and years. What has happened? You know, we just had a new law passed giving the same people more power over the housing market and the banking market and the financial institutions. And so they cause the problem, and they're rewarded with more power and more budgets and more money. That's how government works. In business, of course, it's the opposite. Now, the more you fail, the bigger price you pay. Okay, let me read some of the gossip that's going on here. Just gossip, nothing too important. And so Hayek is hinting at this, and he develops all these ideas, and he talks about them much more in his other book, Law, Legislation, and Liberty. On the chapter entitled Who Whom, you know, that is Lenin's statement, as Hayek says, not John Lennon, but Vladimir Lenin. And the way I like to think of this, I asked my undergraduate students this. I asked them, who has more power over you personally? Bill Gates, the richest man in the world, or the IRS bureaucrat who sent you an audit letter? And not too many of my students have been audited by the IRS, but some of them know that their parents have been. Or who has more power over you, Bill Gates or the person who enforces the local property tax that forces you to pay the property tax? Well, Bill Gates is never able to force anybody, I don't think, to buy his products. You don't have to buy his products, but you have to pay taxes if you don't want to go to jail. Even property taxes, of course. They can take your house if you don't pay your property taxes. And so I think that's a good way of thinking of this question of who and whom that Hayek talks about, is how much power do people in the market have versus people in the government. And when Hayek says in this chapter, it's chapter 8, that he says inequality by design is worse than if it is done by impersonal forces. And he claims that the average person won't object as much to inequality of income if they know it's done by impersonal forces, which I assume he means supply and demand, the market, and so forth, than if it's done by design. And I suspect what he has in mind here is the thinking of James Madison, or people like James Madison. One of the most famous documents in American political history is the Federalist Papers. In the essay, they're all numbered, essay number 1, essay number 39. Essay number 10 is probably the most heavily quoted and widely cited essays written by James Madison. And one of the points Madison makes there is similar to what Hayek is saying here, in that he says that democracies have everywhere perished throughout the world history, where government wasn't constrained to a narrow base of things to be doing. But then once you use democracy for everything, or virtually everything, then inevitably the decisions are made by whoever has the most political power, and justice and fairness will have nothing to do with it. It's just pure, raw political power and numbers. And then Madison went on to say that, well, this is one of the reasons why in the past democracies have always failed, because they've always been seen to be unjust and unfair and corrupt and so forth. That's why we need this limited government democracy, limited by this constitution, he was saying. Of course, that was eventually whittled away at and destroyed, but that's the point he was making, and I think that's the same point that Hayek is talking about here when he says, when he talks about inequality by design is worse than it is done by impersonal forces. If we allow government to go down the path of intentionally creating inequalities deciding, you know, whoever's the strongest gets their way, that's what will happen. When he talks about the role of envy in promoting socialism, it reminded me of, you know, Hayek wrote a famous essay, The Intellectuals and Socialism, and Hayek was always very kind to his intellectual opponents, and much kinder than Mises was, or certainly Rothbard. And one of the reasons why he thought socialism, in addition to envy, is so popular in some circles, among academics especially, is ignorance of economics. And I certainly wouldn't argue that. I had a young student in one of my undergraduate classes, a class is called Capitalism and Its Critics, and at the end of the class, he sent me an email, and he said, you know, I was a socialist at the beginning of the class, but now I'm pretty sure I'm a libertarian. And all he did was learn some basic economics, really, including some of the literature that's on this syllabus for this course. And so ignorance of economics, and it doesn't take a lot of economic education to get honest people to see the truth. The second reason Hayek gave in this essay is the belief in social engineering. That's why people believe, you probably have all heard the saying that if we can bring a man to the moon, send a man to the moon, why can't we solve poverty or whatever? Well, it's human beings are not the same as physical substances. We can't manipulate human beings the way we can metal and physical substances and so forth. And so that's really a strange belief that we can socially engineer society like we can engineer the physical world. Mises had a number of different explanations for this anti-capitalistic mentality besides envy, ignorance of economics, and the social engineering myth. And he writes about them in his book, The Anti-Capitalistic Mentality. And one thing he mentions is the ignorance of what he calls economic democracy. And economic democracy simply means that the recognition that the way the wealthiest business people become so wealthy is to please lots of consumers, the masses, providing things, better products, cheaper products, and so forth for the masses. He calls it economic democracy. He calls it the real democracy as opposed to the political democracy. And so that's one reason. And the second reason Mises gives for the popularity of socialism among intellectuals is that these are people who want to be judged by some sort of absolute standard, and they resent being judged by the market. They resent being paid less than others. An English professor who writes novels, for example, is not paid as well as someone who writes smut novels. Well, if the public wants to buy smut novels more than his novels or her novels, that's what the market says. Capitalism doesn't create that situation. It's human beings that create that situation. But Mises makes the argument that people who are so enamored with socialism, one of the reasons for it is they think there should be some absolute standard. And, of course, they want the government to impose some sort of absolute standard and set up a new government agency to pay them more than what they get paid for their work on the market. He also talks about frustrated ambition. And there's another good quote that I'll bring to your attention by Mises on frustrated ambition. It's related to this. He says this. Let's see. Here he's talking about... I'm getting ahead of myself. He's talking about the entertainment business in particular. Why is it that so many in Hollywood and in the media and entertainment in general are leftist, socialist, and anti-capitalist, even if they work in, for capitalist enterprises? And he has an interesting take on this. He says this: people long for amusement because they are bored, and nothing makes them so weary as amusements with which they are already familiar. The essence of entertainment is variety. The patrons applaud most what is new and therefore unexpected and surprising. They are capricious and unaccountable. A tycoon of the stage or the screen must always fear the waywardness of the public. He awakes rich and famous one morning and may be forgotten the next day. End quote. So that's von Mises saying that even those famous movie stars can produce a few clunkers, and all of a sudden they're nobodies. Nobody knows about them. And that's one of the reasons he gives for why so many of the Hollywood elite, as he would call them, seem to be so enamored with socialism and critical of markets. He also mentions the instability of fame. Rich one day, not so rich the next day, because your movie is a big stinker. And that's another reason he gives. And he also talks about the frustration of intellectuals over their poor book sales when they see some popular writer writing a book on some trivial subject, whatever it might be, selling 3 million copies, and then their book sells 500 copies only at university libraries. They're frustrated over that. So that's Mises' take on various reasons why intellectuals are so anti-capitalist. And I would recommend these two great essays, The Anti-Capitalistic Mentality by Mises and The Intellectuals and Socialism by Hayek. You know, Hayek does endorse the welfare state in Chapter 9 especially. And those of you who have read it, you know that he does. And he certainly does. And he talks about the problem of remuneration under a free market versus a government bureaucracy, the problem of pay. And one of the reasons, one of the ways I usually explain this to students, I give my students a hypothetical example of how I tell them I'm planning on rearranging the grocery industry. And the example is free groceries for everyone, quote, free groceries for everyone. Everyone pays an annual fee or tax for the groceries. We're all assigned to a neighborhood grocery store where you can just walk in and take whatever you want at any time. And then when I get to the labor part of it, I say that, everybody gets paid the same. There might be some seniority ranking, but if you're, you know, if you're a butcher who's been there between 1 and 5 years, you get paid the same as any of the other butchers who work there. If you're a checkout clerk who's been there for, you know, 1 to 3 or 4 years, you get paid exactly the same. Everyone gets paid the same, butchers, checkout clerks, and so forth. And of course, when I go down this list, the students usually recognize it as the way we organize public schools in America. But I asked them the question of what happens if you have a shortage of butchers and a surplus of checkout clerks? You have a long list of people who are qualified to be checkout clerks, but a shortage of butchers. How do you solve that problem? And of course, the only way to solve it in a market is to offer to pay butchers more. But that's impossible, or at least very, very difficult, when government gets involved in setting wages. And that's what Hayek is talking about, how it disrupts the whole market process and causes anarchy in the business world by doing this. Hayek refers very briefly in this chapter to the New Deal, to FDR's New Deal, where he essentially says, makes the point that one group's security is another group's slavery. The government cannot make one group of people more secure through any kind of government program or blocking competition into their occupation and so forth, without also making somebody else being forced to pay for it or keeping them from that occupation. And so it's a rob Peter to pay Paul type situation. And I think it's worthwhile for me to, for those of you who don't necessarily know them, I don't expect you to know the history of the so-called New Deal policy. But the first, what he's referring to here is the first New Deal, which was 1933 to 1935, that he alludes to. Hayek does mention that it was eventually ruled unconstitutional. It was all about government forcing up prices. The Agricultural Adjustment Administration was created to prop up agricultural prices. The idea was, well, farm income is down, we'll make farm income go back up by forcing up price codes on farmers. And then the National Recovery Administration was created to impose higher prices on all businesses. And they hired thousands of price code police to go around enforcing these price codes. There was a famous example of a tailor in New Jersey named Jack Magid, M-A-G-I-D is how it's spelled, John T. Flynn writes about in his book, The Roosevelt Myth, which is a very good old classic book on Roosevelt. And Jack Magid went to jail for hemming a pair of men's pants. He was a tailor. I think the price he charged was 35 cents instead of the government approved price of 50 cents. And so Roosevelt's basic theory was the Depression was caused by low prices. Therefore, if the government forces up prices with price floors, we'll end the Great Depression. And of course, all that did was make things worse because a part of the Agricultural Adjustment Administration program, for example, what it did was it also started the business of farmers, paying farmers not to produce crops and not to raise livestock. Actually, it was Herbert Hoover who started that, but Roosevelt greatly expanded it. And the result was massive unemployment among sharecroppers in particular. There were a lot of sharecroppers in the American South in particular who were the grandsons or great-grandsons of slaves who worked farms, and they generally shared in the income on a 60-40 basis. The owner of the farm got 60%, sharecroppers got 40%. But when the government came around and very significantly forced them to reduce the amount of crops they were growing, it created massive unemployment among the sharecroppers, and many of them fled to the cities looking for work where there was already unemployment in the 20-24% range at the beginning of the Great Depression. So that was quite the disaster, and that's what Hayek is talking about. And both of these things were ruled unconstitutional by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1935. But with the Agricultural Adjustment Administration, the Roosevelt administration just did things such as declaring their policy to be a soil conservation policy. When they kept paying farmers for not growing crops, but they said, oh, the purpose here is not to manipulate incomes, it's to conserve soil. And so they got around that to a very large extent as far as that goes. So that's what Hayek is referring to when he talks about this. And a few other things I guess I'll mention here. We're at 7:51 already that I think that I could add to this is, you know, it really hits you in the face when you read Hayek's discussion in Chapter 9 about this quote, the deliberate disparagement of all activities involving risk, he's talking about socialists, and the moral opprobrium cast on the gains which make risks worth taking, but which few can win. He's talking about the anti-capitalist mentality that was so pervasive in his time against risk-taking. Well, in the situation we're in the world today, the U.S. government in particular was very active in forcing excessive risk-taking and subsidizing excessive risk-taking on the part of the banks. Of course, it was the government, the Congress, that ordered Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, two government-sponsored enterprises, as they're called, to buy up and securitize trillions of dollars of marginal loans, thereby taking the risk out of it. They're supposedly taking the risk out of making these loans. But like so much of the other things government does, when it tries to make life less risky, it ends up making life much more risky. And it certainly did that. It does the same thing with federal deposit insurance. When the U.S. Congress increased federal deposit insurance in the 1980s, it was originally $40,000 per bank account. So if your bank went under, the government would have used tax dollars to subsidize the bailout of you, the saver, up to $40,000 per account. They raised that to $100,000. In the 1980s as a part of the so-called deregulation bill. So this was a new regulation they put on and called the deregulation, banking deregulation bill in the 1980s. And the effect of it was a lot of the savings and loan banks who were in big trouble already took a look at this and said, well, we can take on more risk now because if they and we can gamble by investing in these sort of out-of-the-way retirement communities in the desert in Arizona, that we can make a big killing on these. And if we lose, if no one buys the houses, well, we're covered. The government has now expanded deposit insurance. And so they did. They took on much more risk. And, of course, that created the S&L failure, the savings and loan debacle of the 1980s. So that's a second example of government supposedly reducing risk, but really increasing risk. And unemployment insurance does the same thing. It subsidizes unemployment. So in the name of helping out the unemployed, we create more unemployment by paying people to stay unemployed, as far as that goes. And these are all moral hazard problems. These are all moral different kinds of moral hazard problems. And Hayek is talking about this in his own way in this last chapter. And I have 7:55, so I think that'll be the end of my the formal lecture here. And I'll be glad to get into the questions. And I assume, as we did last week, Grayson, that I'll just read some of the questions. I've printed out the questions. And I'll read them and give you my take on them. Let me look here and see if there's any gems of wisdom here on the screen. No, I don't see too many gems of wisdom. Okay. But anyway, let me go through some of the questions. These are not necessarily the order that they were submitted. This one's from Mattai. A few months ago, I attempted to write a paper on ecology. My research led me to Harding's Tragedy of the Commons. It's an essay, The Tragedy of the Commons, by Garrett Harding, and to some of Eleanor Ostrom's work. Eleanor Ostrom was a co-winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics last year. Ostrom's view differs from that of Harding. Common property, she argues, does not always mean overuse and poor management. If people are free to develop their own institutions, common property can turn up better results than private property and government property. I'm not sure that's an accurate statement of her position, but that's what the question is. Some Austrian economists agree with Ostrom's conclusions. They even bring into discussion some of Hayek's work on institutions and laud Ostrom for her continuation of Hayek's ideas. What is your opinion on common property defined in the above terms? Well, I think what Eleanor Ostrom does is she distinguishes, for example, between open access and the types of common property that are privately owned, that where there are property rights in land. And so open access would be like the open range out west where the government is the owner of the property, and cattle ranchers let their cattle just range, go everywhere, and create deserts by overgrazing. But Eleanor Ostrom distinguishes between that and common property that is owned like a homeowners association that owns a piece of property, or a corporation that owns the mineral rights to some minerals, to oil or something like that. Those are similar institutions, but not identical. The open access creates a more severe problem because the people who own the property, the common property resource, have an incentive to take care of it. One example that some libertarians have been giving for quite a long time, who study free market environmentalism, is private fishing clubs in Scotland that have bought up land along the rivers where the salmon come in from the sea and migrate back and spawn. And in order to fish for the salmon, you have to buy a membership in the club because it is private property. And so that's a way in which they can capture some of the ocean salmon, which were previously just a open access resource. And Eleanor Ostrom's career, much of it has been spent in studying all the different ways in which groups of individuals try to solve some of the problems like overfishing of salmon in various ways like this. And so she doesn't say that common property is better than private property. She studies various forms of ownership and how people try to deal with these problems that are generally called commons problems, but they're not all identical. And she's very insistent. If you go online and read what she has to say, or if you read her Nobel Prize speech, she's very insistent that there are no panaceas, there are no rules. So in that sense, she's very un-Hayekian. She says there are no hard and fast rules that we could use to determine how to deal with these so-called common property problems. She's a little more eclectic and ad hoc in that regard. So she's not like that much like Hayek, I don't think. And I'll go on to the next one. Let's see. On the interview of Hayek, I assume we're talking about the online interviews I sent over to Grayson last week. That university in Guatemala put online all these interviews, video interviews with Hayek. And it was kind of funny for me to see some of my old friends, Jack High and Tom Hazlett, with their 1970s hairdos interviewing Friedrich Hayek. But it was very interesting. But on the interview with Hayek, he said that his disagreement with Mises consisted in methodology and utilitarianism. To me, Hayek seems much worse of a utilitarian than Mises by far. How is it that he claims not to be a utilitarian? And this is from Arturo. Hayek was a utilitarian. I don't think... But he changed his views on a lot of things. If you compare The Road to Serfdom to some of his later books, he did evolve like most human beings would. He didn't stick with the exact same ideas. But he's also known as being an advocate of what's called rules utilitarianism. And you've been reading about his discussion of the rule of law. And he goes on and on at great length, talking about how we should adopt certain rules based on utilitarian logic. That is, if it seems as though they do more good than harm, then it's a good rule. It's still a utilitarian argument in that it's based on some sort of benefit-cost calculation, but philosophers distinguish this from what they call act utilitarianism, which is not about rules, but about individual actions and doing benefit-cost analyses of some sort. The critique here is that as an Austrian, Hayek should have known that or remembered or relied on the idea that benefits and costs are subjective. They're not measurable. They're not objective. They're in the minds of the decision makers. And so it really is impossible to do any kind of benefit-cost analysis of these things in a very accurate way. Although when you look at rules, you can think of a lot of rules, like rules against murder, that have evolved over time. Who would not say that's a good rule to have, that thou shalt not kill? So he distinguished himself as a rules utilitarian for the most part, and I don't think he could be believable in saying he was not a utilitarian, because you're reading his work right now, and he makes all kinds of utilitarian arguments about benefits and costs. Let's see what some of the geniuses are saying here. That's way over my head. Okay, let's see. Next question by Russell. Is Barack Obama in a similar situation, similar to Hitler, to hijack the government, as any strong figure was in Weimar Germany? Well, I certainly hope not to hijack the government. I don't think he's going to burn down the Congress and declare himself dictator. I don't think we have to worry about that. But the point I would make, though, is that the American presidents nowadays don't really see themselves as being constrained by hardly anything, certainly not the Constitution. George W. Bush was famous for calling it something like an old piece of paper, and the Congress takes pretty much the same attitude toward the Constitution, and so presidents for a long time have not really been limited very effectively by the Constitution, and Barack Obama is no different than a lot of his predecessors in that regard. But I wouldn't compare him to Hitler as far as that goes. Then he asked about all the czars. Well, I've mentioned the czars. Yes, we have all these awful czars who are even less accountable than your typical government bureaucrat, even your typical government agency. The Appropriations Committee of Congress still holds hearings, and they bring some of these people before them in public with television cameras and ask them what they're doing with taxpayer dollars. A lot of it is a charade. A lot of it, of what happens is the agency will be doing exactly what Congress wants it to do, and Congress knows that the public will disapprove of what it's doing. And so what it does is it brings the agency heads up there, and there are televised hearings, and they point their fingers and they chew out the agency heads, and the agency heads take all the heat politically for what they're doing. And then when it's all over, the Congress responds by giving these agency heads or these bureaucrats bigger budgets. It's their way of rewarding them for taking the political heat for the things they're doing. So a lot of what goes on is not really oversight. It's really one big charade aimed at pulling the wool over the public's eyes over who's really responsible here. And the czars are even removed from that. They're not even going to be, at least as frequently, called in as, say, the head of the EPA or the head of the Department of Energy would by law. You know, by law, the chairman of the Fed has to go before the House Banking Committee and get reamed out by Ron Paul once or twice a year. Let's see. Given the central planning effect of the product of a democratic body, should we suspect that the recent laws have been written outside the government, i.e. delegated to an organization with a very narrow and self-effectualizing view? Well, that's how congressmen works. How Congress works, basically, a lot like the new the healthcare law and this banking law, it's all written by staffers and lobbyists, and all the staffers become experts in a particular industry or business and how the law will affect that business. And the game is to do the bidding of that business, that corporation, or that industry group, and then get a job with them, paying high six figures and being handsomely rewarded for your work in having this obscure law passed that could mean millions of dollars to this corporation, and that's your payoff for it. If you want to read a book about the Hill staffers, there's an old book, it's at least 20 years old now, called Hill Rat. That's what they call themselves, Hill Rats, and that would be one book to read about how this sometimes works. So yeah, that's how it always works. Are we at the point in USA, given the concepts in The Road to Serfdom, where liberty, not democracy, is about to collapse? Well, it all depends on us, doesn't it? It all depends on what we do about it. That's one of the themes of The Road to Serfdom, is that Hayek was saying, I'm not predicting that it's inevitable that we are going to be serfs to the state. In fact, he said, that's why I'm writing this book. I'm trying to warn the public that we need to fight this. And so I'm not willing to say that, it's hopeless. We're serfs to the state. The people of the Russian Empire had every reason to believe that 20 years ago, but they peacefully seceded and escaped the Russian Empire, the Soviet Empire. Okay. Let's see, another question by David Ranello. What other roads to serfdom did Hayek analyze in his career? Did he study local communities that fall under strong dictators? It seems that the same roads or patterns have been occurring throughout history in a fairly predictable manner, no matter the scale. Well, that's true. An interesting book to read in this regard is The State by Franz Oppenheimer. And he talks, I think I mentioned this in the first lecture, he talks about the creation of states as basically being through conquest of one group by another. And so the whole history of the state has been the history of one group using the state as an apparatus of coercion to conquer and enslave and tax and conscript another group for its benefit, for the first group's benefit. So yeah, this is nothing new. In response to the question of what other roads to serfdom, I would say if you read Law, Legislation, and Liberty, published, I think it was 1976, Hayek talks about what had gone on between The Road to Serfdom and that time. He criticizes, it was a three-volume set of books, and one of them is subtitled The Mirage of Social Justice. And so he had studied very seriously all the claims of the so-called social justice literature. That's why I put the article by Anthony Flew on the reading list about social justice. Hayek mentions it here in The Road to Serfdom in these chapters that we have for tonight. And then 30 years later, he wrote very extensively about social justice. And so I thought it would be useful to give you at least a little taste of some of this literature. And Anthony Flew was he just passed away not too long ago, a very well-known libertarian philosopher from England, and I highly recommend reading him. He was one of the libertarian heroes of the 20th century, for sure. Okay, next question. by Roger. Let's see, in chapter 9, Hayek mentions that the business cycle and recurrent waves of large-scale unemployment require much, quote, much planning in the good sense, end quote. He fails to elaborate further, the result being quite unsatisfying. So the question is, you know, first question I assume is, you know, what does he mean by planning by the good sense? Well, I would think he would have meant planning the appropriate rules, the rule of law, as far as that goes. And I think in the very next sentence in this passage, he talks about some economists. He doesn't say me. He says some economists think that monetary policy would be a favorable way to stabilize the economy without interfering in liberal virtues and in freedom. And he probably had in mind the Chicago School Milton Friedman rule. They used to call it the monetary rule. Milton Friedman once thought that it would be a kind of nice if the Fed could be forced somehow to increase the money supply by 4% a year, every year, regardless of whatever else happened. And why 4% or something close to 4%? He used to say, historically, that's how much GDP grew during non-recession times, 4%. So keep demand growing through monetary policy at the same pace as supply. That was Milton Friedman's basic argument, excuse me, to maintain a stable price level. The Austrian view of this, however, is that you could still create malinvestment and boom and bust cycles by expanding the monetary supply year in and year out. You don't need to expand it 4% a year every year for the next 100 years to have stability and still have boom and bust cycles. But that's probably what Hayek was referring to. But since he doesn't say exactly, I can only guess. But as far as what he mentions, good planning, he probably means planning in terms of the appropriate constitutional rules, limiting the government with a constitution. He was a constitutionalist. In fact, his next major book published in 1960 was The Constitution of Liberty. And so I think that's what he's probably talking about. Second question here is, do you think that Hayek would have approved of central banks that provide, quote, much planning? No. One of Hayek's books was entitled The Denationalization of Money. And so he of course was a major participant in the development of the Austrian business cycle theory. He was employed as the head of the Austrian Business Cycle Research Institute. He spent a lot of years there doing that, and that's where he developed a lot of his expertise on business cycle theory and his understanding that central banking was the main culprit in creating boom and bust cycles. And so, no, Hayek would not be a fan of that at all. Let's see. This is from Stephen Wise. How can Hayek refer to the case of the miser as pathological, page 98 of The Road to Serfdom, when he positively endorsed Walter Block's book Defending the Undefendable, which defends the actions of the miser as economically sound? When you provide a blurb for a book, which I've done on numerous occasions, you don't necessarily say that you agree with every single sentence in the book. I can't recall the exact blurb that Hayek gave for Defending the Undefendable by Walter Block, but he didn't need to agree with everything that's in the book. He could have just said, well, it's a good sound economic analysis, and while I don't agree with everything, I'd like to see more people use Austrian economics to understand the role of all of these economic actors in society. Something like that. You don't need to defend the miser. Okay, that's his own personal opinion. Second part of this, is the miser erroneous to believe that there are purely economic ends separate from the other ends of life, or is he simply exercising free choice? Well, he's exercising free choice. I know people like this. I know people who are hardcore Randians, who really do believe that the worth of a human being is based on how much money he or she makes. And doesn't mean I agree with them, but there are people like that. When Walter Block wrote about the miser, he was writing about a minority in the population, I would think. Okay, let's see. Here's a question, another question by Stephen Wise. Does Hayek mean to say that, quote, potential plenty, page 107, means that a properly planned economy would produce a larger output than the same economy being allowed to operate as a competitive free market system? No, I'm sure he's not saying that. Hayek would never have said that. Hayek, after all, was, along with Mises, was the major participant in the socialist calculation debate of the 1920s and 30s, and he never would have said that. And is it true that this term is no longer being used to support the notion that a planned economy is superior in terms of output produced? I don't think anybody makes that argument seriously anymore, that a planned economy will produce better output. The argument quite some time ago changed to, well, we need more intervention for fairness and social justice and all these other things, the redistribution of income. The socialists have pretty much given up on the argument that a planned economy could be superior. And they'll say it could be more environmentally safe, more equitable, more just, and so forth, but they won't say that it'll produce more stuff, more goods and services. Is this the underlying notion of Keynesian-style government interventions in the economy? I assume what is meant by this is Keynesian-style government interventions, will this type of planning grow the economy? Well, yeah, that's what they argue. And I would, since you all have very different degrees of education in the field of economics, and I don't know how many of you have actually studied macroeconomics, but if you ever have had a course in it, and you sort of vaguely know what it's about, Google Robert Higgs and the word vulgar Keynesianism. He wrote an article that was on the Mises web a while back, talking about some of the myths and superstitions that were created by Keynesian economists, that they became very popular. The main reason they became so popular, in my view and in Bob Higgs's view, is that they provided a plausible-sounding rationale from intellectuals for politicians to do what politicians always want to do anyway, spend more money than they take in tax dollars. And, of course, the politicians were smart enough to pay intellectuals by giving them government jobs, government grants, prestige, and so forth, in return for their intellectual support for these ideas. But, you know, as one example, I was taught this when I was an undergraduate, of the balanced budget multiplier. I was taught that if the government taxes, say, $1 billion, takes $1 billion out of private hands, and then spends it on something, the end result will be GDP will actually go up. It won't just be a replacement, a decline in $1 billion in the private sector and an increase in $1 billion in the government sector. It'll be somehow magically, through the multiplier process, make us all richer. And I remember as a freshman in college thinking, well, gee, the logical implication of that is if we send every bit of our paychecks to Washington, D.C., we'll all get rich. Every time you get a paycheck, send it to Washington, they'll send it back 120% of what you gave them. And that's how we get rich, if this is really a true theory. And so they invented all these strange notions. And and I've read the general theory. I read it in graduate school, page by page. And if you're a student of economics like I was, I already had a degree in economics, the one thing that strikes you is there's really no economics in it until way at the end. There's no discussion of prices and markets and resource allocation by prices and price signals and shortages and surpluses. It's all sort of a mechanical engineering exercise, social engineering exercise. And Keynes himself, by the way, in the German language edition of The Road to Serfdom, admitted that it is quite a famous quote that the Keynesians rarely, if ever, bring up. He said that his system would work much better in a totalitarian society than in a democracy by forcing people into these things. And so that was his take. And so, yeah, they do make the argument that this kind of government planning will be good for the economy. And we're seeing it on display now. The linchpin of the argument for Keynesian planning that they use is World War II. Because we went through the Great Depression years in the U.S., And the Roosevelt administration ran up huge deficits. They employed over 10 million people in government jobs, and still by the 1939 or 1940, the official government unemployment rate was still in a 14-15% range. And whereas before the Great Depression started, it was 2.9% in 1929. And so all the New Deal spending programs did not end the Great Depression. And so what they say then is that, well, World War II did, because we really spent a lot of money in World War II compared to the New Deal years, compared to the 30s, and that's what ended the Great Depression. And they say, well, here's the evidence. There was no unemployment. We went from 14-15% unemployment to essentially zero unemployment. And the big fallacy in that argument, as Bob Higgs has pointed out in some of his writings, is that they forget to point out the fact that something like there were about 5.5 million people unemployed in America in 1939. The government conscripted 11 million men for the military. And so, of course, there was no unemployment to speak of. There was just full employment. And so so the implicit assumption there that the Keynesians make is that a person who has a real job, gets a paycheck, and goes home to his or her family every night and lives a normal life, that's essentially the same as shipping some guy off to Germany to sit in a foxhole in 10 below zero weather and risk getting his head blown off. It's all the same, which is absurd and ridiculous. But that's the argument that Keynesians all rely on to this day, that World War II got us out of the Great Depression. But as Bob Higgs pointed out, and Bob Higgs writes about all this, he put all these writings in his book, Depression, War, and Cold War, that was published a couple of years ago. As he points out, the government actually reduced the federal budget by two-thirds from 1945 to 1947. I think the numbers were approximately from about $95 billion, with a B, in 1945 to $35 billion, that range, by 1947. So about a two-thirds reduction in real dollars, in absolute dollars, of federal spending because of the demobilization of the military, and that's what made the economy take off finally. And another thing that helped out is one of Bob Higgs's articles in this book was also about how the constant anti-capitalistic attacks by the Roosevelt administration created such great uncertainty that it was harmful for business. And that's sort of what we see today, right now, today, with the Obama administration threatening a giant new energy tax now. Nobody knows how much taxes are going to be necessary to fund their socialized medicine schemes, but everybody understands they're going to be huge. And all the regulations and all the czars, this creates tremendous uncertainty. And of course, businesses are not investing as much as the government would like. And so you have Keynesians like Paul Krugman making the case now that the government should start buying up money market funds and doing the investment itself, things like that. But it's the government itself that's creating all this uncertainty, which is horrible for investment. And that happened during the New Deal years. To be sure, FDR and his advisors were as virulently anti-capitalist as the Obama administration is. But once they were gone, things were much better. And investment did pick up, and that's what created the boom of the late 1940s, was the drastic cutback in government spending. Just the opposite of what the Keynesians predicted. They were all predicting a disaster when the government did this. And by the way, I mentioned the GI Bill earlier. The Keynesians were all predicting a massive unemployment when the veterans all came back, because there's something about a Keynesian economist that they makes you impossible to understand how markets and prices work. Of course, with a big flood of labor entering the labor supply, it doesn't necessarily mean there will be unemployment. There might be lower wages in some industries for a while until productivity picks up and there's more capital investment over time, but that doesn't mean there'll be unemployment. At some price, everyone can be employed if prices are flexible, if wages are flexible. And that's pretty much what happened after World War II. And the Keynesians, they're used to thinking in this sort of mechanical engineering mindset where the economy is C plus I plus G, and they don't think about supply and demand. They were predicting this. And so they thought the GI Bill was absolutely necessary because they wanted to hole up millions of veterans in colleges and universities and trade schools, keep them away from the job market, was their argument, because there would be massive unemployment like the Great Depression. And they were totally wrong about that as with most other things. Okay. And see, that's the last question I have printed out here. Let me look at the chat and see if anybody else has a question. Go ahead and write it in here, and I'll read it off and try to answer it. Grayson, as usual, is doing a great job in putting all the things that I mentioned up on the site here. Yeah. An example of what I mean by the markets will clear as long as prices can fall is I mentioned the first New Deal earlier, 1933 to 1935. The second New Deal was different in that the focus was on increasing wages in particular. And so we had a lot of labor laws that strengthened labor unions. We had the minimum wage law. We had payroll taxes that increased the price of hiring labor to employers. Unemployment insurance was invented, so we had unemployment insurance taxes. And so almost everything that was done in the so-called Second New Deal, 1935 to 1940 roughly, made it more expensive to hire people. The unions pushed up wages because they were empowered by legislation to do so. The minimum wage law pushed up the minimum wage. Payroll taxes increased the price of labor even more. And so at a time when you have declining demand, you're in a depression, the only way to keep your job is to negotiate a temporary wage cut, because at some price you can keep your job. It's economical to keep you on, but not at the old price. There's not enough business. We're in a depression. And so all of this government policy did exactly the opposite of what had to be done. And the book that I mentioned earlier in the course, Out of Work, by Lowell Galloway and Richard Vedder, is an excellent exposition of this. And they use econometrics to estimate that unemployment in the United States was, I think their conclusion was, about 8 percentage points higher than it otherwise would have been during the 1930s because of these laws that propped up prices and during the late 1930s anyway. And so instead of having 14% unemployment, it would have been 8 percentage points lower, they estimated. And there are other countries like Canada that didn't do these things, and they recovered from the Great Depression much quicker than America did, because they didn't pass the same kinds of laws that we did. Maybe they eventually did, but not during the 1930s. Okay, Joe Green has a question, since we still have some time. I speak of the role of the militarization of the police and politicization of the military plays on the road to serfdom, and what Hayek had to say about the topic. We certainly seem to be seeing this today with the police taking on military-like tactics in the war on drugs. The militarization of the police, I can't recall Hayek mentioning this, because it probably wasn't as stark as it is today, where, for one thing, so many of the police are former military people, because we have so many veterans now because of all the additional wars we've fought. It's a tradition now that's what former military people do. And of course, the war on drugs has a lot to do with that. I think with the military, as a lot of you know, a lot of the normal laws that apply in a civil society, there are exemptions made for them with the war on drugs. And so a lot of that has to do with the war on drugs as far as militarization of the police. Here in Baltimore, you may have all seen examples of this. I was driving through town one day, and there was one of these tanks. It looked like a tank, but it was the local police, the Baltimore cops, had this big ironclad vehicle. And there was a man on the ground, very thin man, had just been beaten into a pulp by three or four cops, and he was bleeding on the ground. And the tank pulled up, and a bunch of SWAT guys jumped out. And they picked this guy up and put him in the tank and drove off with him. And I observed the whole thing. And I have no idea what this guy was doing or why they were beating on him like this. And there were no cameras. This would have been a big internet spectacle if anybody had this on camera, including me. I didn't have my camera cell phone with me handy at the time. But, yeah, that sort of thing is going on. And Hayek, I don't think Hayek ever experienced that sort of thing in England or America. But, of course, he knew about Nazi Germany. This is the kind of thing that had been going on in Nazi Germany. So a lot of what he's writing about in The Road to Serfdom, he makes reference to Nazi Germany. This is what's happening with the militarization of police here today. That's why, historically, America... Americans have tried to keep a separation between the military and the civil police. But that separation is, seems to me to be fading off. Okay, let me see. We've got to have a few other geniuses asking questions here. We have a few, some time. Does Hong Kong still have no minimum wage? I'm not sure about that. I haven't kept up with Hong Kong since the Chinese government took over. Maybe some of you know about that. I don't think Bob Higgs has studied that at all. Let's see. Question number six in the quiz. We changed that answer. That was the answer was C, and there was a typo in my my answer list, and but Grayson is changing that. So the answer to number six was C, and I talked about that first part of the lecture tonight. Was how in the U.S. Regulation means that the government controls a lot more than just the 40 or 45% that you look at as, in terms of taxes. Let's see what else we have the right. Billy Baru is calling it a night. Alan Burton, compare and contrast the Nazis and the Brits, Nazis and the British after World War II. Well, as Mises wrote, and Hayek too, especially Mises, if you read the Middle of the Road Policy essay, the British adopted pretty much socialism during World War II and kept it. That's why they kicked out Churchill after World War II. In fact, one of the reasons Churchill lost the election, according to some of my old acquaintances in England, was that he kept quoting Hayek. He was a friend. He knew Hayek and he had read Hayek. He had read The Road to Serfdom, and on the campaign trail after the war, Winston Churchill was quoting Friedrich Hayek and The Road to Serfdom, and the British people didn't like this idea that there was this guy with a sort of faintly German accent, and Churchill was talking about the threat of a Gestapo arising in England. The English people didn't like that, and so the Labour Party succeeded, and they adopted Fabian socialism. And in one of my articles on the Mises website, I think it's called 4,000 Years of Price Control, I quote a book called 4,000 Years of Price Control. And there's a story in this book about one of the famous Nazi, Hermann Göring, who was in prison after the World War II. And he was interviewed by an American journalist. And the American journalist was asking him about the German economy, of all things. And there was Hermann Göring telling the American journalist that that you Americans need to get rid of these Nazi economic controls, because the Americans were mostly Keynesians at the time in the occupation authorities as far as economics was concerned, and they kind of liked the Nazi economic controls. It was just like the New Deal. It was almost identical to the New Deal, and so they kind of liked that, and they kept it in. And so here's Hermann Göring saying, oh, we tried that, and it was disaster. You can't plan people's lives. We tried every way possible. And of course, thank God for the German people that, that Ludwig Erhard, who was the German finance minister, took it upon himself to just eliminate all the control, the price controls, on a Sunday afternoon. When the story is the American occupation, the head of the American occupation authorities, the head general, came in and asked him, what have you done? It was too late. It was too late. The free market had been set in place. And so, the Germany deregulated, and England went more on the road that Germany had just left, the road to serfdom with Fabian socialism. Let's see. I think we have time for one more question. I know it's 8:32. Let's see if we have another question. Grayson came up with the minimum wage laws passed in Hong Kong July of 2010. Wow, that's horrible. A horrible idea, but not surprising. Okay. Okay, well, I guess that's it. There's no more questions, and it's 8:33. If any of you have any other questions for me, feel free to email me. I'd be glad to talk to you or share it on the list with the class. And I guess Grayson is about ready to do some more reading, I guess. And so take it away, Grayson. And thanks for sitting in. Thanks for all the thanks.